If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
And it was never the goal to make gobs of money. It was a goal, if you would, a quest to make great wine.
And it's the same team, you know, treating every tank and every wine with the same respect. And, you know, same barrel sourcing, same, you know, I help my clients out with finding glass and corks and labels, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's all in the family to me.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 478. This week we feature Nick Goldschmidt, owner and winemaker at Goldschmidt Vineyards in Sonoma. Spending time with winemaker Nick Goldschmidt is simply fascinating. Vineyards and winemaking really go beyond passion for Nick. His knowledge is deep, but he always explains his views on wine in easy-to-understand terms. Every conversation is a wine education filled with lots of laughs. I thank Nick for this interview, as he had just arrived from Chile the night before and took time to meet up with me at his office in Healdsburg. Cheers, Nick. You can watch our video of the interview with Nick on our YouTube channel. You can also hear Nick on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term dimers and trimers. Back in Sonoma, good to be here. Good to be here with our friend Nick Goldschmidt. Nick, how are you?
Awesome, Ray. Good to see you in my office, or good to have you out here in Sonoma County.
Yeah, it's nice. Last time we visited, it was in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
That's a beautiful place, too.
It's a nice town, I have to say. Although this time of year, it starts to turn a little ugly, if you know what I mean. It is a winter thing. But here it's still nice. A little chilly today.
Well, I was sitting in Chile yesterday.
Yeah, it was
nice and sunny down there, and they get on a plane, come here, and here we are, cold.
It all changes. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And that's the thing that's interesting about you. And I should preface it by saying you are the owner of Goldschmidt Vineyards, and we've been a fan of that wine for quite some time, and it's unique how you do things. But you work on many parts of the planet. So let's take a couple minutes to talk about that. You were just in Chile. And you were there for, did you say 6 weeks?
Yeah, 6 weeks between Chile and Argentina. But it's something that I got lucky with. You know, I was 28 years old. It was 1992. And I was a winemaker at Simi Winery. And Simi at the time was owned by Louis Vuitton. And they owned a number of still wines around the world. Cloudy Bay, Cape Mantel, Rufino in Italy, Terrazas in Argentina, Roses in Portugal, etc. And so they sent me out on sort of a blending mission around the world and meeting very famous winemakers and great brands. And I sort of carried that mantra through with me as we got purchased by Constellation. And then later on in my life, I left and went to Allied Domecq and Jim Beam. And they had the same thing. In fact, Allied Domecq had 58 wineries around the world. And so I got to live on an airplane for 7 years. But man, the contacts I've made and the... You know, I learned so much about so many different places and met so many great people, and learned really the true meaning of terroir is largely influenced by the culture and the personalities of the people as well, not just the soil and the environment that wines are made in. And so I sort of carried that with me around as I consult around the world. And today I still work in 6 countries. But, you know, if I ever get asked a tough question, Ray, I can always just pick up the phone and call one of my old friends from Spain or Portugal or wherever. I'm always one phone call away from the answer, you know, so that's been great.
Well, it's going to be fun for you, too, is that every time you see these people, you're just picking up where you left off.
They become really close friends, exactly. And I tell each winemaker that I work with or viticulturalist that I work with that, you know, you and I may not work together for the rest of our lives, but I know exactly where you live, and when I retire, I'm going to come hang with you, I'm going to drink your wine, hang out with your kids, hang out with your wife or your husband, and have a good time. But because that's really what the wine industry is all about, is the passion of the people. And, you know, wine people and vineyard people tend to be the sort of people I hang out with anyway.
So. Yeah, yeah, they're fun people. Absolutely. And you're that kind of a guy because you kind of warm up to people very quickly.
I hope so. Well, a glass of wine doesn't help.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. So for our audience then, who may not be familiar with you, and they should be, you talk funny because you're from New Zealand.
So
yeah, I left. It was interesting times back then. My first vintage was 1982, believe it or not.
Wow.
And yes, I was in New Zealand. I have 2 degrees from New Zealand, but there wasn't any wine school back then. So I was in agriculture. I was doing, well, horticulture. I always wanted to be a row cropper, garlic, carrots, onions. And
really?
Then I discovered grapes. They had a few vines on this research plantation where I was. And so I ended up going to Wagga Wagga in Australia, which is the big vit enology school they built right between the halfway between the Yarra Valley and the Hunter Valley, which are two famous appellations in Australia, and they built a wine school there. So I did viticulture there, and then after that I did a postgraduate in enology at Roseworthy in Gawler, which is closer to Adelaide. And then I returned to New Zealand for a couple of years, and then headed off to California. My first vintage in California was 1989. Went back to Chile and Argentina, was in France, got a phone call, ended up at CIMI for the vintage of 1990, and I've stayed in this town ever since, so 32 years now in beautiful, beautiful Healdsburg. You know, we're 1 hour from the Golden Gate Bridge, we're in the heart, we've got four appellations, Russian River, Chalk Hill, Alexander Valley, and Dry Creek, all meet in Healdsburg. Huge wine community, and you know, it's just a fabulous place to visit, fabulous place to live. Yeah,
it is. It's a great place. You're not far from the square walking distance, which is kind of cool, and one or two fairly decent restaurants. So, yeah, you could have a good time living here.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll always bump into a winemaker wherever you go.
That's the fun thing about it. Running into a lot of people, as I've done just during this week I've been here, is great and fortuitous for our audience, again, to tell them and confess that I actually almost pretty much pulled you off an airplane after you got back from Chile and dragged you into your office on a Sunday, no less. So once again, I say thank you, sir, very
no,
much.
No problem. I've been here for 10 hours, so we're fine.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Good. I've had a sleep.
And you've relaxed. Good luck. So let's talk about your wines. You're primarily making wine here in Sonoma, and I say primarily, that's kind of seems to where your heart is, I'd say, more than anything. Is that fair?
Well, it's where my family lives, you know, and we own a number of properties here in Sonoma County. So my main focus is obviously Alexander Valley Cabernet, which I've been making since 1990 at CIMI, of course. And Russian River Chardonnay, which, of course, CIMI was known for a number of years before they came more well-known for Cabernet. And then the other big passion for me is Oakville. And so I make a number of wines from Oakville. And the reason, I mean, you may argue that Rutherford is perhaps a little bit more famous appellation, but I find the tannins in Rutherford, you know, they talk about the Rutherford dust, and sure enough, the tannins for me are a little bit more grippy. I mean, great wines, but they tend to be a little bit more grippy, whereas Oakville for me is more similar to Alexander Valley in terms of the silkiness. And we can pick the grapes a little bit lower in alcohol and still end up with this really fine grain tannin. You know, we often talk about, you know, obviously I make wine in New Zealand, Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. I still do that under Boulder Bank and Forefathers. And what I look for is, like, when you drink that wine, you get, you know, am I hungry or thirsty? And you get that tension, you know, you get that line and just explodes in the mouth. And I find that you can get that also with Cabernet if you get the acidity correct. So in the Alexander Valley, if you're looking for the difference, but for me, between Alexander Valley and Oakville, Alexander Valley tends to be a little bit more red fruit. So you get, you know, high-end red fruit is strawberry and raspberry, but we tend to be more red cherry, blueberry, a little bit of black cherry. With Oakville, we tend to start at blueberry, black cherry, and then we go down from there. So, but the acidity tends to be the same. We tend to get a little bit brighter acidity. And acidity, we don't really talk about when we describe wines because people get put off by what that means. But it's important for longevity. And as wines age, you need that support structure for the wine to remain in that fruity element. And if you have too high an alcohol, too much residual sugar, it moves away and you lose that tension of the wine. But with a little bit more acidity, it stays brighter and younger and more youthful. And so that's what we look for.
Nice. There is a difference between Napa and Sonoma, certainly as there are in different AVAs and certainly sub-appellations. But I'm a big fan of Cabernet from Sonoma as well, much as I am from Napa. The difference being that Sonomas can be a little more affordable from time to time, which is nice. Is that a totally different process for you when you make your wine between Napa and Sonoma?
Yes and no, but it's very tricky. So we talk about site-specific winemaking, and here in the Alexander Valley, I know it sounds weird, I use more hillside fruit than I do in Oakville. So Alexander Valley is a very narrow valley. You've got east and west, and the sun obviously comes from the rises in the east and sets in the west. So you want to have these east-facing slopes because these are cooler. And in Alexander Valley, they tend to be very steep. So it's very hard to get these vineyards. And so a lot of people plant west-facing, which is obviously warmer because you get the afternoon heat. So we make the wines differently depending on what the exposure is, how old the vines are. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it, but and the drainage is a big thing, how much water holding capacity we have, etc. So the bottom line is I like to make wines that are single vineyard. So how do I make complex wines from one vineyard? And that is by picking across different soils within that vineyard. These vineyards are relatively small, so each soil may only be 1 or 2 acres, but I'll bring them into the winery and I make them a little bit differently. So if it's a thin soil or more free draining soil, I typically lower the extraction. I don't want to extract it too much, because if it's a thin soil, you tend to have small berries. When you have small berry, you've got high skin pulp ratio, so your tannin are much higher relative to the fruit. So I extract them a lot less. I lower the temperature, shorter pump overs, etc. If I have a deeper soil, then I extract more because I know I'm going to be more fruity than they are tannic, so I can ferment a little bit warmer, I can extract them more. But then during maceration, I let the temperature cool down because I want to maintain that tannin. And the way you measure success for me is, you know how wines move from purple to red to brown to orange? Red wines should be, you know, purple to red for about 20, 25 years before they start transitioning. And for, you just got to have the history. You've got to have made wine from these vineyards for, you know, for me, I've been making wine from the same vineyards for 30 years. So I know how they're going to react in a good year and a bad year and a hot year, a cool year, a wet year, whatever. And that history is really important. In Oakville, I tend to not do the low extraction. I tend to extract more because I pick a little bit earlier. The berries tend to be a little bit bigger than they are in hillsides. I'm also on a hillside in Oakville, but it's a north-facing slope, so it's much, much cooler. And that's where we make the Game Ranch comes from, Oakville. It's this beautiful little north-facing hillside, bigger berry than you would be, believe it or not, on the valley floor, which is thinner. So quite a unique site. The Yeoman, which is our top Alexander Valley vineyard, is north-northeast. It's a terrace, and so I can extract that fairly well too. But Catherine, which is our biggest selling wine, is something that's, you know, I try to make that really user friendly, and that's why it's become a very popular wine. But going back to your point about Alexander Valley, Ray, there's not a lot. I mean, when I first started, I think back in 1990, there was a lot of individual Alexander Valley Cabernets. Today, there's not a lot. I mean, I can name a few wineries around, but a lot of other people are buying the fruit here and blending it into other brands. Wow. Yeah, it's a real shame. Yeah. And I think Alexander may have lost its way a little bit. But we have some great, great wineries that are still here, obviously.
Yeah, I agree. Do you do anything at all in Knights Valley?
No, Knights Valley for me is, well, I can't do everything, right?
Folks, I just want to announce that he's got 7 more arms behind his back. You just can't see them.
Knights Valley's I've had some great wines from Knights Valley. There's 2 very good brands that are made in Knights Valley, great vineyards that are made in Knights Valley. But the day-night temperature is pretty big difference there. And also the soils are really unique. I don't know if you know this, but Russian River formed the Napa Valley, right?
Sure.
Mount St. Helena was lifted up in an earthquake. So even though it's magma, it's not a volcano. Then there was another earthquake, and this mudslide came off Mount St. Helena, and that's what blocked the Russian River. And that's why the Russian River now flows out to Russian River Valley. So you can imagine the soils in Knights Valley are quite unique and quite different. Whereas in the Alexander Valley, it's more traditional. But it was not only formed by the river, but it was also formed by earthquakes. And so what's interesting, you'd normally think that the older soils would be at the bottom of the hill. You know, as the Russian River comes through, you're going to get more erosion, more exposure. But because we had so many earthquakes, it's sort of the opposite in the Alexandra Valley. So the top of the hills are about 300 million years old, and down by the river it's only about 3 million years old, which is kind of crazy when you think about what happened geologically way back, you know, when the monkeys were swinging out of the trees. And
yeah, it's funny to think of just how the history of the land has changed everything and created these two major winemaking areas that are so very different in so many ways. And then, of course, you have the ocean that plays in as the wild card, I guess you'd say. We mentioned before that some of your wines are named after your children. You said you had five kids. Are they all... I remember your son. Does he have a wine named after
him? Yeah, my son... I do have one winemaker son.
Who I have interviewed.
Who you have interviewed previously, yeah. And it was quite interesting just on this trip where I was down in Argentina. I had to pick up all his wine because he was still there during COVID. And had a really, when COVID first started coming out, and Argentina was not really set up, so he couldn't get out of Argentina until June, I think it was, 2020. That was pretty difficult for him. So I had to pick all his wine up. But no, the wine really started as a family project in 2000 with Chelsea, my oldest daughter. And so when she was two, I traced around her head and then she colored it in. And that's where the label comes from. You can see it on the Catherine bottle. But if you imagine it's purple, that would be the Chelsea project. So in 2000, I was telling my kids about how we used to make wine in Chile without electricity. They're like, yeah, whatever, Dad. Because Pinochet, when he was the dictator in Chile back in those days, the way he controlled people is obviously he can cut off oil and power and et cetera. And so making wine without electricity is quite interesting.
I can't even imagine.
We tried it. So in 2000, we hand-destemmed, which is very laborious.
I would say.
Pigeage, punched down, basket pressed, and then we pumped it into a barrel. I did put the barrel in a warehouse. I'm not that stupid.
Good idea.
Yeah. And then we hand-bottled it, and we call it Five Gold Hands Unplugged. Gold being Goldschmidt, unplugged being no power. So in 2000, Chelsea wanted to make wine with me. And so for those who are fathers out there, having a relationship with your daughter is kind of tricky. From like 13 to 19, daughters don't typically talk to their fathers. But having a family project together has been wonderful. It's been a great experience. In 2002, I started making wine with Catherine. And then in 2005, I think it was, I started making wine with Hillary, my youngest daughter. But it's been an awesome family project and great storytelling, and each one of them are very into the process and into the wine. And I have many videos of them working with me. It's been tremendous.
Oh, that's great. What a tribute for your kids. That's pretty cool. You've been in this business for a long time. Who's your hero? Who's your mentor or mentors?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think... Yeah, I mean, my first mentor, obviously, was a guy, Max Loder. Max Loder was a German viticulturalist at Wagga. And he was the one that, you know, we're New Zealanders and Australians, and we didn't really travel that much, but Max was from Germany. And so the way he ate food and drank wine, you know, I'd never heard of Sousa before, which is, you know, half-fermented grape juice and eating onion cake. And I mean, what the heck is all this about? I mean, you know, I'm like 24 or whatever. I didn't know anything about wine. And very quickly after that, obviously, Joe Babich from Babich Wines. Joe and Peter Babich, they really taught me. Joe taught me how to work in the cellar, how to make wine from the grassroots, because we didn't have like winemakers back then. Winemakers worked in the cellar every day. We didn't sit in an office and just taste wine and write work orders. I mean, we were hands-on. I learned how to rack and ferment and, you know, barrel ferment. This is crazy. And then from there, Zelma Long, she's the one. She was president of Simi Winery when I started. She was the second female graduate out of UC Davis. She was the first non-Mondavi winemaker at Mondavi. She was the first winemaker in California to do barrel fermented Chardonnay. And she lives very nearby here today. And she's just an amazing, amazing lady. From there, I've had many other people who have influenced me, but I had a really close relationship with a very famous consultant, Michelle Rolland, who's from Pomerol. And I always laugh about that relationship because, you know, people talk about how great Cabernet is. Well, Pomerol is the appellation for me in Bordeaux, and yet it's mainly Merlot. And, you know, Petrus is actually not that bad. Obriona is actually not that bad. I mean,
these are
Merlot. Yeah, quite drinkable.
Yeah.
These are Merlot-based wineries. And I joke that Michel, he taught me a lot, but he taught me two things. He taught me how to be a consultant and have fun with it and embrace the opportunity to work with people. And then secondly, he taught me how to blend. And to this day, I think of Cabernet in five ways. I always, when I drink a red wine, any Bordeaux varietal, I always think of the five families. There's green, simple, which we don't care about. And then the other three are elegant, powerful, and dense. And elegant wines are wines that have good structure. They're all up front, very jammy, juicy, red fruit. And then the powerful wines in the middle of the tongue, which are the richness and the flesh. And then the dense wines, which provide the structure and the finish. So when I was a young winemaker, I walked into a room and had to make a reserve $75 Cabernet. And I mean, when was the last time, Ray, you had a good bottle of New Zealand Cabernet?
Let me think about
that. Yeah, exactly. It still doesn't exist.
Yeah.
We're still struggling. We can't even get Merlot ripe, let alone Cab. So I'm thinking, how am I gonna make a complex wine when I didn't really know how to make Cabernet? And I'm sitting there a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit of this, you know, 3 months later, and I still end up with this product that's not, like, completely satisfying. But working with Michel, he told me that you sort wines into families. And so we put all the elegant wines together, all the powerful wines, all the dense wines, and we made a blend of the best elegant, the best power, the best dense, and I had three wines, boom. You know, 20 minutes later, I've got the best wine that I could have ever thought of, and much less effort, much more clarity, and I still hold that today, and that's where that site-specific winemaking statement comes from. You know, okay, these blocks always make elegant wines. Okay, what am I going to do in the winery or in the vineyard to even make those elegant wines even better and better and better, and the powerful wines better and the dense wines better? And so that's where site-specific winemaking comes about.
That's a big challenge. Blending is fascinating to me in general, just because the idea, number one, of burnout, I would think. I mean, we know, most people know you're spitting, but it's still a very, very focused process. Are you solo on this? Do you have some people with you? How does it, and it, does that vary with each winery you're working for?
Yeah, I never taste alone. I never taste alone anyway, because my memory takes me back to a vintage that was similar, a person that I had it with, or the winemaker that I was blending with at that time. It has to be intuitive as well, because you're putting the stamp of the area. It has to be Alexander Valley Cabernet. I mean, yeah, I can look, if I can give you a Cabernet from Maipoke or Chawa, Kachapol, McLaren Vale, Barossa, Alex, Oakville, if I make everything at 25 bricks and 14.5-15 alcohol, you can't tell the difference. So we have to make the wine true to type, and this is where true terroir comes from. It's a representation, your representation, your cultural representation of that area. And I never want to taste alone, because I'm never 100% perfect. And it's also, when I'm consulting, that winemaker has to put his stamp. I mean, he's the one she's going to be out in front of the people, representing the wine, telling the story. So that person also has to agree with the way that we're making the wine as well. That's so, so important.
It's direction, I guess, is what you would say in the long run.
Yes. I give an example. I worked for a large company once where I gave five winemakers 10 tons of grapes. I made the picking decision, so that's half the decision's gone already. And each winemaker got delivered this 10 ton. And at the end of the year, I sat down with the five winemakers. All the wines were completely different.
Yeah.
You know, so where's the terroir in that? I mean, you're limited by what happened at the winery on that particular day, and did you get it to barrel on time, and did you rack it on time, and then what profile were you trying to target as well? So, no, it's really the person putting the wine together, the person making the wine, is also really important to representing the terroir too. So it's quite difficult.
Yeah, I'd say. Well, that brings me to the idea of tasting with people. You know, one thing cool about you're very approachable, you're fun to talk to, and you disarm people by not, while you can be extremely technical, you can relate to people. So I'm not trying to kiss your butt here. I'm just trying to lead to a point where I'm sure plenty of times when you're at tastings, whether it be at a dinner or whether it be at a whatever function you may need to go to, when you're getting people that are challenged and fearful. And again, our goal is making wine less scary. How do you approach people like that? How do you walk them through something without actually holding their hand?
It's like an interview process. I've been asked by a couple of leaders of the industry to work with their winemakers. And I'm like, okay, that's cool, but I have to have the winemaker be comfortable with me before that process occurs. And to go back to your question, normally we'll taste 250 glasses of wine in a day, but I always know that my sensitivity is right between 10 and 12, 10 a.m. and 12, and then from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. So when we're tasting 200 plus wines in a day, we'll always blend between 10 and 12. And 4 and 6, because that's when I'm most sensitive, you know, is before dinner or whatever. And so I think when I'm forming a new relationship with a winemaker, it's important to taste a lot of wines and then during those times just really dial in and focus and make sure that he or she is comfortable with the way that we're tasting and the way we're talking and interacting with how that vineyard looks and how that wine represents it. So I had an incident recently. I was just in Argentina, as I said, 10 days ago in another new relationship. And it was interesting because the winemaker didn't have much understanding of vineyards, because sometimes a lot of these winemakers work in very big wineries and suddenly they have to be making, you know, $100 bottles of wine. So how are they going to transition from their current day-to-day practices to going high level and going into the vineyard and talking to them and sharing and obviously having the vineyard manager interact as well and making sure there's some cohesion there and that I give them a kind of a, hey, if I was here, if this was my thing, if I was doing a $100 bottle of wine from this soil, I'd be looking and farming like this. You can agree or disagree, but this is a relationship that you've got to have with your vineyard manager to dial in and then sitting down and tasting wines together, like bringing the vineyard manager in. A lot of vineyard managers don't taste. And it's so, so important. You know, we can all make a $10, $15 bottle of wine, but that's not the future. The future is making wines that are interesting with personality. And you've got to have everyone involved, the vineyard manager, the assistant winemaker, the winemaker. They've all got to be cohesive and going in the same direction. So tasting wines together and discussing, hey, you know what, if we get this vine in more vertical position, we get better light exposure, and unfortunately, you know, the row direction is not perfect, so how do we compensate for that, sure, both in the vineyard and in the winery, and just throw out ideas, but never say, hey, this is the way to make wine. No, there is no correct way to make wine.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I've met plenty of winemakers who are highly educated, plenty that are by the seat of their pants and making very good wines as well. And a lot of it, of course, comes from experience after a period of time. Especially because you make wine in so many different places, what's the weirdest advice you've ever been given? Something that you're kind of like, what, really? Maybe it worked and maybe it was insane.
Well, normally it's skepticism, you know, hey, how can you come in here and say that you think we should farm in this way? Well, for me, it's you've got the trellis, you know, maybe you planted the trellis, but you actually didn't really understand how that trellis is supposed to work. And one of the funniest ones is VSP, which is basically used around the world, no, vertical shoot positioning. Now, it was basically invented in New Zealand because we had botrytis. But because it's easy to mechanize, people start using it around the world. But there's a verb. It's called positioning, vertical shoot positioning. So I walk into these vineyards and these, you know, shoots are like this instead of like that. And so how do we get shoots into this position because it's highly manual? So the easy way to do it is by spur pruning. If you spur prune, you can get the position of the spurs, the buds, more in a vertical position. Unfortunately, today, we have huge amounts of trunk disease around the world. And we're getting trunk diseases because people are not pruning correctly. So when they, you know, when you have a tree and you have a branch, right, people prune here.
Sure.
That is not the correct way to do it. You want to prune here, let the wood die, and then the next year you cut dead wood. if you cut next to the tree, that wood is actually dying back into the trunk of the tree.
So you're talking like a couple inches.
Yeah, so actually it can be more than that. So you're stopping the phloem and the xylem up and down the tree. This is also true in a grapevine. So when you have spurs, you're actually making pretty big cuts. So now we go back to cane pruning, which the cuts are much smaller. It's hard to understand, but you're only cutting one-year-old wood rather than two-year-old wood or three-year-old wood. So when you make smaller cuts, you've got less chance for some of these trunk diseases. So firstly, getting people to understand, you know, VSP is shoot positioning, and then discussing with them your typer. I walked into a winery the other day, pretty well-known winery. It's pretty interesting. And I wondered why I wasn't liking the wines. Everyone else seemed to be liking the wines from this particular producer, but it wasn't sort of my cup of tea. And I walked into the winery, and this winemaker poured me his Cabernet, and I looked at the color, and I'm like, man, this wine is brown already, you know, purple, red, brown. It's already there. So I'm in my mind, I'm going, this guy's got trunk disease. He's got Eutypa. And either that, or he's got a warehouse that's at 100 degrees.
Yeah, so that would be bad.
It's one of those two options. So yeah, sure enough, the next day I went into the vineyard and walked around by myself, and sure enough, you know, a lot of trunk disease, a lot of Eutypa, a lot of spur pruning situation. So I can see that coming through in the wine. And yeah, so...
How did that go down?
Well, I didn't mention it, of course.
Oh, you couldn't? Oh.
No, 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 because I don't consult for them. It was just it was a friendly visit. But it's quite easy when I do consult for somebody to, okay, hey, let's do a vertical. You know, let's do a 5-6, we don't have to go back far, just 5 or 6 years. Let's do a 5-6 year vertical and see where the transition occurs from youthful wine to middle-aged wine to an old wine. Well, you'd have to go back 20 years for an old wine. But I did the exercise recently because I was having a problem with a particular winery, and I said, you know what, I'm not quite getting through to this winemaker. So I said to her, I said, could we taste 6 years, seven years? So she opened 7 year vertical, and sure enough,
there it was.
Wow. 4 years, wine was brown.
Just a little detective work.
And it wasn't because of anything that was occurring in the vineyard. This was a bottling and a storage issue.
Oh, really? Wow.
And so it's really hard to convince people that there is an issue until you can somehow prove there's an issue.
I think that's, unfortunately, a story I've heard many times is it's the objective person walking in, especially with experience, and saying, without stepping on their toes or offending them, but yet still making the point that you've got a problem. As the old saying goes, you can't solve a problem until you've identified the fact that there is a problem.
And it can go bigger than that too, Ray. When I work in Okanagan in Canada, I was thinking, Okanagan, this is going to be amazing. This is going to be cool climate viticulture, cool climate winemaking. No way, man. The Okanagan is relatively warm because it's inland, it's a true valley, and you have a very short window for harvest. And so the temperatures can be quite high. This is 2010-11. I started wandering around the valley, and man, these wines, for me, you know, no offense, the Chardonnays were fairly high in alcohol. The tannins for the red wines tended to be fairly dry. And they're on granite soil up there, pretty free draining, and you got a lot of heat. You know, it doesn't really cool down at night. So when I was invited to work up there, I like jumped at the opportunity because I thought there was so much potential. And sure enough, the winery that I work for up there now has become like probably the most sought after winery. Our first vintage together was 2012, but starting in 13, it's been an incredible ride. And you know, the minimum bottle price up there for us is $150 a bottle, and we're on complete allocation, and you know, we're quite different. So
yeah,
quite a different wine to everything else that at the time was being made in the Okanagan. So it's just, sometimes it's a fresh eye and a fresh approach.
Sure.
And the winemaker there, man, he is just fantastic guy to work with, and so detailed and so focused, and he's really pushed the envelope on what Okanagan can do. So that's looking at it like on a one winery in the whole Okanagan basis versus, you know, four, five or six wineries in Maipo where there's a lot of evolution going on, and it's a and everyone's competing, and the region is really growing. You know, so and then you come back to Alexander Valley and Oakville, and we're already beyond that. You know, we are 90% of all the wineries are already at that level, and we're nickel and diming to get better and more. I don't know. It's confusing, but it's a happy place.
But it does make sense. I mean, I get that in terms of evolution of areas, no different than different parts of the United States. But I just want to go back real quick. Okanagan, what part of Canada is that?
Okanagan's in British Columbia, so you can go to Kelowna. There's one appellation, as you fly into the airport, you'll fly over Vancouver Island. So there's a bunch of wineries on Vancouver Island. And then you cross the Cascades, and then you land in... there's four lakes in the Okanagan. Okanagan's... Vassis, Skara, and Osoyoos, Lake Osoyoos actually crosses into the US. And so you think of it being a Pinot Noir Chardonnay producing area, but actually we're better off growing, well, for me, Merlot down in Osoyoos, which is the warmest. And, well, personally, you know, I think the Osoyoos Lake is a very interesting lake to grow grapes around, particularly Chardonnay and Merlot, which we're focusing on, yeah.
I know I've asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you again because I like the question. Gosh darn it, I ask every winemaker this question. What is the one question that you've not been asked that you would like to be asked?
I think it's, you know, I'm almost 60, right? Like, what is it that, what can lead you to the next step? Or, you know, what do you want to do before you, like, sit back, smoke that cigar and, you know, drink a whiskey, you know? And well, for me, I did something... 2 years ago, I started making this, we call it ultimatum. And I really wanted to, ultimatum means the ultimate or the last or, so, okay, I don't think I'm there. I mean, maybe I'm not close to death, but but this is the ultimatum. And this is the finest thing after, what did I say, you know, like since 82, you know, this is after all these years, this is it. This is the quintessential that I really wanted to make. And this comes from an amazing vineyard in Oakville that I'm so lucky to work with and have worked with for 25, 30 years. And it was a kind of a joke. It started like, where do I want to go? What do I want to do? And I'm like, you know, if Kim Jong-un drops a nuclear bomb and we all run to the bunker, what are you going to take? You know, so it has to be something, like it has to be something that I've had experience with for such a long time, and I really want to see this wine age, and I'm going to be this close to it, you know, for 15 years when I'm in the bunker. So this is it. This is the ultimatum. So we only make two barrels of it. It's a very rare, very exclusive wine. And it's just something that, you know, it's like, there's a famous magazine that asked, you know, who wrote an article about who are the 40 best winemakers under 40 years. Oh, well, when Kim Jong-un drops the bomb and we run to the bunker, they're not the wines I'm going to take.
Yeah.
I'm going to take wines from my mates who are probably 50 plus, who have experience from the same vineyard for so long and can bring that history with them. Look, we can all make wine, Ray. It's not an issue. But can we make a wine that's true to type, that represents that family, that person, their prowess over, you know, 30, 40 vintages, and really take it to the bank and say, man, when I go down to the bunker and I've got 15 years, that's the wine I'm going to be taking. So this is it, the ultimatum, and that's really what I've been working towards all this time.
Well, let's hope we never end up in that bunker, to be quite honest. Yeah, so we can sit true. Back and enjoy it together. That would
absolutely
be fun. Nick, for our listeners who'd love to learn about you, and you can, they can certainly check our website for the previous interview we did a few years back. But for our listeners who'd like to learn about you now, what is your website?
It's www.goldschmidtvineyards.com, G-O-L-D, gold, Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T, vineyards, V-I-N-E-Y-A-R-D-S.com. And you can always follow me on Instagram, which is, I probably put a video up every 1 or 2 days, depending on which country I'm in, whichever country I'm in, and that's goldschmidt_vineyards. And so, yeah, you can follow me there too.
I love watching the videos, because in the end, if you are a geek enough like I'd like to be, you want to learn about this, you want to understand what you're doing, and you describe a lot, and it's great. Nick, thank you very much for taking the time today.
Ray,
really super appreciate it.
Thanks for coming to my office all this way here in Healdsburg. I really appreciate it. And hopefully I'll get out and see you soon when we can all start traveling much more freely again.
Look forward to that.
Learn more by visiting goldschmidtvineyards.com.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geisha. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.